in the course of doing Nexus magazine, I get to meet and read lots of interesting people and read lots of interesting information. Now, I'm sure, how many people here are familiar with the book The Keys of Enoch? How many people have read it? That's the sort of category I fit into. You start reading it and you realise, wow, this is really something to put down for a special time when you've got a few hours to digest it. You know on the inside there's some very interesting stuff in there that feels really right. So I'm still waiting through my study. I hope some of the readers are here. Anyway, it's in my sort of job, you see a lot of speakers of interest. You hear reputations preceding them of, they've got problems with ego or sex or they've got weird, wonderful peculiarities. Our next speaker has got none of those that I've ever detected. He's one of the most enigmatic people I've seen or heard of on the circuit. And a couple of years ago at Dennis McKay's UFO conference, I was really intrigued because I thought, James Hertak's coming, I'm very keen to meet this guy. And he wandered over to my table and I just stood there sort of steaming away, lighting up magazines and putting them towards him. And very interestingly, he made some comments on one or two articles which no one ever makes comments on. And there are articles which I considered really important. And one of the articles in particular was from Major Jordan's diaries, which is, in my opinion, it's proof positive that at the highest level, the Cold War was a total hoax. It shows you how Russia armed America, how America armed Russia with the nuclear weapons capabilities, etc., etc. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the two articles we ran. And when I put that article out into the internet, I thought Americans would be particularly irate. I thought they'd jump up in arms, and I thought it would really rattle the saber, because here at long last was a book which had been really suppressed to the point that not many people had heard of it, and we were able to participate in addressing it. James came along and commented on the article and told me that he'd researched some of those facets and found them to be absolutely true, and complimented me on running the article. And there were several other articles he mentioned also, and I thought to myself, man, what an astute guy for picking on that. So that prompted my decision this year to bring him out. I also had heard rumours the last time he was here that he showed a video after the UFO conference, and I must have been friends with about half of the audience, because the next day there were about 10 phone calls from people saying, Duncan, you should have seen this video we showed. It was under the pyramid of Giza, and they had these temples, and it was just mind-blowing. And wow, this is amazing. I got on the phone, actually. I got on the phone to Hancock, Bovale, John Anthony West, and asked a whole host of so-called experts if they'd heard of the video you were showing, or they knew anything about the expedition that was on there. No one had heard a thing. Not a thing. So one other side thing I should mention, I noticed that James seems to have a tendency to come to Australia and release information into the public domain for the first time. One example of this was the Face on Mars. Many of you probably associate that with Richard Hoagland, who sort of ran off of all the credit. But James here came out, what year? 80? 70?
It was published in 73.
Right. When did Channel 10 show the first footage that you...
Channel 10 in 1984.
Yeah, 1984. That's years before. That's what, 10 years before Hoagland and the rest were...
And keep in mind the story is not true on that account.
Right, of course, what I hear. So, I'm hoping that he's well, I know now, but I'm sure you'll find some more information coming out in today's lecture that hasn't been out in the rest of the world yet. The title of the talk is The Opening of the Time Doors in Egypt, Asia and the Pacific. And to give a bit of background information, James J. Hertak, PhD, is founder and president of the Academy for Future Science and author of The Keys of Enoch. He's a social scientist, remote sensing specialist working in the field of archaeology, a former professor at California State University, Northridge in California State University, Los Angeles. His educational background includes the work at the University of California and the University of Minnesota. He was one of the consultants for the NBC award-winning documentary The Mystery of the Sphinx from Charlton Heston, which featured recent archaeological evidences on the Giza Plateau. He's worked regularly with scientists of Japan in the Okinawa in the first underwater documentation of the pyramid-like monuments of the team of Bits and Pace, who created the technology for the feature film Titanic. Doesn't say it here, but I know James was also an advisor or researcher for Sidney Sheldon's novel, The Doomsday Conspiracy. Did anyone read that? It's one of those airport paperback novels that you see there, but it's it's a fascinating read. And I read the book and I thought, wow, I wonder who nudged Sydney Sheldon with some of this information. Turned out to be James Fairfax. So please give him a big warm Nexus conference welcome, and I'll leave you with the next 90 minutes.
Thank you, Duncan. It's a great privilege to be here in Australia at this meeting point of history where we're rushing into the 21st century. I'm going to cover some of my recent archaeological work in the Near East and more recently here in the Far East, specifically on the floor of the Pacific Ocean. Before we get started, let me simply say that the documents represent research in progress, because several scientists are involved with this research from Japan and in the Middle East, from Egypt. Some of this information is very, very sensitive, and thus I would appreciate no pictures being taken. Some official document can be made through the Nexus management and family. Secondly, I have worked as an advisor in many programs, many universities and think tanks, and the views that I present this morning are strictly those of my own research. Anything that may seem too super-rational or irrational is up to your selective factors, so please use your logic very, very carefully. Several of the exhibits are those of metaphor, historic symbolism, and cross-cultural analysis to remote sensing. So I ask you to be very, very patient with the presentation. If we can fasten our seatbelts, I would like to begin with the new image of man that is emerging in the 21st century, Homo Noeticus, a humanity that understands that the construct of time can be transcended. The humanity that understands that we are just as much in space as space is within us. A humanity that understands there are tremendous breakthroughs around the corner. Some would call the research of zero-point energy and cold fusion as a harbinger of a whole new field of consciousness quickening. And in this context, I would like to present a historic dimension of where past, present, future converge. I'm going to use as my point of departure the Book of Knowledge, Keys of Enoch. In Key 215, or Section 215, we are told that round numbers will appear, connecting the heliocosm, or the multidimensionality of space and time, to various geometric forms that will be seen on this planet. On page 305 of my book, it is stated, key number 15 tells the children of light to look at the ancient megalithic sites at Teotihuacan, Palenque, Tiwanaku, the Terran Basin, Stonehenge, the Great Pyramid and the Sea of Galilee, to see the round numbers and calculations of star mathematics, which are part of the greater astrophysical geometry. When this was written in 1973, few people understood the importance of Stonehenge juxtaposed next to the Great Pyramid, or the fact that the teachings speak of multiple Stonehenge areas. Areas were ancient calendar systems, like we see here, analyzed by Joel Hopkins with an IBM computer. Then, side by side, the interesting phenomenon of the so-called crop circles, or round numbers, just as they were described. I talked to Colin Andrews. He was quite shocked that specific details were given in the keys, including phonetically the spelling of certain names that would appear in the field crop circles. We've all seen some of the interesting forms of the Julian set from Mandelbrot and some of the other metamathematical symbols that have appeared in various areas around Stonehenge, more than 1,000 of these crop circles in the 80s, but this was written in 1973. The teaching about coordinates certain mathematical calculations of activities in England and other parts of the world with specifics in Egypt. We see, for example, in 1991, a remarkable series of pictographic notations analyzed by Professor Michael Green as representation of the Egyptian name Amun-Ptah. Here we have a clear identification of the work that's registered as Mill Hill. Dr. Gerald Hopkins has looked at this very, very carefully. He considers this an interesting possibility of a type of intelligence that is really not terrestrial, not using our forms of logic. And yet there is something that is not looked at by any of the government scientists, an actual logogram of symbols that spell out a specific name. Now, if we turn to the book of Knowledge through Enoch, in 1973, I state the word Amun-Ptah in terms of certain mathematical geometric codes that will be written upon the earth. What am I saying? There's a connection between what I was shown in my higher consciousness experience between the programmers, the celestial architects, and the trumpet call of awakening the human race to realize Matthew 24 is knocking on your door. And all due respect to Jeremy Lee, Jeremiah the prophet also blows the trumpets. And we have to take seriously, in spite of the smokescreen of all of the geopolitical scenarios that tend to move our mind into great despair, that there is help on the way. This is the work of Enoch over the Stonehenge area. Just a few years back in 1994, one of my colleagues captured this picture of a capstone, a pyramidal-like vehicle that appeared, known also as the Merkaba, the ancient prophetic word for the divine vehicle. Not a flying saucer, not a metallic spaceship, but something that shows the higher architecture upon which Stonehenge, the Great Pyramid, and the Oriental temples, and those of the Native Americans all point to the heavens, which means we are part of an upward evolution. We are not meant to be destroyed by the powers that be, no matter what camouflage of the extreme left or the right. If we read carefully the symbols, then we are of the upwing. The higher imprint of knowledge that we have received in our ancient text, if you read it very, very carefully, tells us a remarkable story. And here I quote from the Nag Hammadi text of Asclepius. This is found in Egypt in 1945. The text tells us, "Are you ignorant, O Asclepius, that Egypt is the image of heaven? Moreover, it is the dwelling place of heaven and all the forces that are in heaven. And if it is proper for us to speak the truth, our land is the temple of the world. And it is proper for you not to be ignorant that a time will come in it when the Egyptians will seem to have served the divinity in vain, and all their activity and their religion will be despised. For all divinity will leave Egypt and will flee upward to heaven." It's quite a remarkable statement. It means that the early Coptic Christians realized that the symbols in Egypt, the tombs, the so-called mystery stones, were part of an architecture that went back to a much earlier period of time. More recently, in 1998, scholars and Egyptologists were shocked to find the existence of another Stonehenge, that in southern Egypt, next to the Sudanese border. And here we see some of the outcroppings of these small stones, upwards of 2 or 3 meters in height. Next. You see the measurements of these stones that are placed in circles and alignments very, very similar to what we have in England and other parts of the world, megalithic centers. More specifically, this being orientated with the major planets, the solar movements, and also the orientation with Regulus. So we can have the first view graph. We see the area of the megalithic sites at an area called Nazca, close to the Sudanese border, measuring from the orientation of the monolith, there is a grid of several megalithic points going over several thousand meters, and scientists, by analyzing the cannibal burial regions, the bone fragments, have carbon dated this going back to some 8,000, 9,000 years ago. This would put this area close to the end of the last ice age, about 9,000 BC, and also would throw light on the activity of an astrophysical priesthood that could make very substantial and sophisticated measurements of solar and lunar movements. These were not simple food gatherers. They were connected with the vast system that we now know from radar analysis of underground radar rivers, as they are called, that run up and down the Nile. Next, new graph. Looking more carefully at the outcroppings, we see the standing stones, the lines of sites. The southwest window of the circle that is called the standing monolith. Again, complete absence of light as we know, but we know to look beneath the sand cover by approximately 4 to 6 meters, we see a different Egypt, an area that was very, very different, an environment that could sustain human mobility and traffic. We go to our slides. So as we reconstruct the face of Egypt with remote sensing technology, we move into a whole different cycle of history. Herosis, the great historian, cited by Pliny the Elder, speaks of time cycles going back 490,000 years BC. Diodorus of Sicily, who chronicles the gods and the heroes of antiquity, speaks of Egypt going back some 33,000 years. Monico, the great Greek historian, speaks of a time cycle of 24,927 years where gods and human architects were side by side. George the Sensilis speaks about 25 Celtic cycles or divine cycles of 36,525 years. If we look at some of the findings in Ethiopia and Sudan, such as the Tiberias text, we have a very interesting story regarding Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, our idol. We are told, among the presents that Solomon gave to the Queen of Sheba were, quote, a vessel where one could travel over the sea, and a vessel where one could travel by air. Does this mean that there was some type of celestial navigation? You see, if you look at the upper right-hand side of this pictograph, a strange reptilian being, and it certainly was a small laser, we see a human subject with wing-like appendages, a being that has a sphere on the face, and also the sacred cattle, or the Apis bull, which represents the tombs of Saqqara, the four sons that represent the divisions of the human race, and very interesting notations that are magnified in the lower left-hand side of the screen of a treasury of ancient documents and records that were placed beneath the ground that would throw light on the earlier experiments that was brought to this planet by the divinities of the higher worlds. In the 1970s, I requested permission to go to Egypt to do research regarding the blueprint of the Keys of Enoch and had an opportunity to use laser technology, to use musical technology, and later in the 1990s, again, my colleagues at the Academy for Future Science found themselves working with a close-up of the documentation of alleged wounds beneath the paws of the Sphinx. Here we see an aerial perspective of some of the areas that are being cleared away. The amphitheater before the Sphinx proper has been removed. The German Egyptologists have been successful in finding a strata of tunnels. And the whole complex of Egypt has changed since
Robert Schock and John Anthony West stated that the water lines show great fluvial activity, hence Egypt was not dry, that some 10 to 12,000 years before, there was great water activity that would have cut into the sides of the Sphinx. Signature going some 1 to 2 meters deep. Now let us take a closer look at the symbolism here, and please stay with me, because the text that we are finding, we're finding an avalanche of new records in Egyptolis. In that day, that country that was more pious than all countries will become impious. No longer will it be full of temples, but it will be full of tombs. Neither will it be full of gods, but it will be full of corpses. O Egypt, even Egypt will become like the fables. And what is to be said about this? The Egyptians? For they, the Egyptians, will not abandon Egypt. For in that time, when the gods have abandoned the land of Egypt and have fled upwards into the heavens, then all Egypt will die. Namely, there is a scenario here, even in the Christian text, that points to the importance of this symbol. That the work that was done in the 70s with colleagues from Stanford Research Institute using transducers and seismic equipment allowed various pictograms or micrographs of information, as we see here in this comb-like series of patterns, to show where openings or tunnels or vaults existed under the sand. We see here the counterpart to the footprints of the camel on the surface next to one of the pyramids. Thus, by looking very, very carefully at the echo patterns of the return movements of the thumping of the hoof, seismologists and remote sensing experts could detect the possible entrance of other rooms. Next. Here we look now at the reality behind the Sphinx, the pause of the Sphinx, not the newly restored pause. Next. But what is said here on the stela of Thutmosis III. That beneath the Sphinx there is a grid-like system of cubicles or geometries that would house the prehistory of the gods or the heroes of the ancients. And if one takes this in context of Neo-Egyptology and paraphysics, it means that there is a counterpart even to the Sphinx that is buried there somewhere along the Nile. It gives us a clue as to where these underground rooms and chambers are. We are told in our Bible, in Genesis 49, of the great blessing that Jacob gives to one of his sons, first died in chapter 49 of Genesis, the lion cub Judah is. From the prey, my son, you will certainly go up. He bowed down, he stretched himself out like a lion, or a sphinx, and like a lion, who dares rouse him? The scepter will not turn aside from Judah, neither the commander's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh or the Messiah comes, and to him the obedience of the peoples will belong. Esoteric Christianity has taken this to be the sign of finding special rooms. And so with permission, I'm going to show you now some of our findings on the back side of the great Sphinx. They connect not only with underground passages, but also with the entrance into the pyramid complex of Giza and Khafre, Giza and Cheops. We see here the inside of the Sphinx. We see a hollow tube, according to my colleague, Lamper Dolphin, one of the leading scientists at Stanford Research Institute. In the complex, there was found a water capsule area some 9 feet deep, which was used for ritual initiation or some type of baptism. Why the hollow interior
Let us turn now to our first video document. We turn off our cameras. We see Dr. David Hawaii
has been never opened before. No one really knows what's inside there. But we are going to open it for the first time.
Machine finally down again here beside the sink now. When I showed the trailer of Dr. Hawaii, he said how they will be back, and he agreed that there may be other openings.
Oh, yeah.
Right, we were interested in bringing down the technology and actually checking out the perspective.
Oh,
and the biblical account of the 7 years of famine were years where there was storage of special documents to go back to a much earlier phase of history. We look at the reconstruction of the possibility of a second Sphinx. The second Sphinx is on the horizon as Regulus. The great Roman astronomer Claudius Ptolemy, about 135 BC, wrote of the 27 principal stars of magnitude 1 to 6, and Regulus. But also, if you look at the reconstruction and the pictures of the Sphinx on the horizon, you will see that there are lines connected with the underground portals of the Sphinx. That is to say, there are matching connections. They go approximately back to 10,000 to 12,000 BC. Regulus also is a very important area because it is the area of the immediate universe where we have the highest concentration of gamma ray radiations. It is a symbol that repeats itself as the jaguar in the temples of Mesoamerica and the lion in the temples of China, the Orient. So what am I saying? I'm saying that there is a much higher meaning to the lion symbol that even Jesus refers to in the Gospel of Thomas, where we must assimilate the power of the lion and put on the face of the lion as the symbol of the sun. Using the radiations of light, we shall then complete the initiation, understand the symbolism of Egypt in the sense of the higher worlds. Center for Research scholars also have used thermal infrared remote sensing to look at the size of the three major pyramids of Giza. We see here the infrared image of the pyramids show concave and convex mirror-like effects during the day cycle. And the pyramids are mathematically constructed in such a perfect orientation as to suggest other relationships, not only with the pyramids, but also the rotation of Saturn in terms of the magnetic and geomagnetic influences of the nearby planets. The three pyramids, according to Enoch, represent the Bible in stone. The capstone that is missing represents the final stage of our human evolution reaching up and using the energy technology and the spiritual technologies, they can use that term, to complete the linkage with the higher worlds. Here in 1977, two of my students working with lasers looking at the so-called air shafts and star shafts on the north and south sides of the Great Pyramid are pictured in a higher state of meditation. More recent expeditions, however, have been focused with the understanding that the symbolism of the pyramidion or the symbolic capstone in the Museum of Cairo represents nothing less than the three stars of Orion's belt, the region of Imsak, aligned with our sun, our solar evolution, and they in turn will open our eyes to see that we are connected with a greater evolution, connected with the Kolob, as it is called, or the central sun, the wings of which descend at a time that we have completed a certain stage of evolution. Here physically, the capstone completes the next phase of that evolution. Now, the Egyptians plan to place a capstone on the Great Pyramid next year. The French have been commissioned to work with this artificial capstone. We'll see what happens when this takes place.
those places. It's okay.